Kevin, you mentioned you're, if you don't want to answer this, that's cool, but you mentioned an NDE earlier. I'd be very interested to hear about that, but if you don't want to, that's cool too.
Oh no, yeah, it's cool. It's not the most amazing story, but it's just something interesting. When I was like 18, I was into the anarchist squatter punk culture, and I was mixing it up with some squatter folks and some activists and stuff like that. So I'd gone traveling for the summer, and it was kind of this, just in terms of my personal story at the time, it was like I dropped out of school and just decided to go for it and travel the country and be a bum and just explore and stuff like that. So it was this pinnacle of my youth and a lot of youthful energy. And while I was out there on the road, I'd had this really interesting illness for like 4 years before we went traveling. And it's very interesting. It's a very shamanic kind of thing that would happen. I would basically seasonally, once every couple months, I would get really, really sick. And I'd wake up and have this twisting pain in my gut, really strong pain. It would cause me to throw up all day. I couldn't hold down water. I'd get completely dehydrated. My body would just clear out entirely. And then the pain would get so intense that I would start having visions and stuff. I had some really crazy hellish visions a couple of times, some very weird kind of out of body, like wavy experiences too. But they're hard to kind of remember just because there was so much. It was like an illness thing, you know. I'd go to the doctor all the time. They never figured out what it was. The best they could tell me was that it might be this thing called cyclic vomiting syndrome, which they explained are kind of like migraines of the abdomen that are related to stress. And I was definitely at a stressful point in my life. I was definitely like, I had messed with a bunch of really crazy over-the-counter drugs for about 6 months, like Robitussin and Dramamine and all a whole bunch of crazy stuff that really messed my head up. So, but the illness was happening for years before I started messing with that over-the-counter stuff too. But anyway, so we went traveling, and I had a feeling that while we're on our summer trip, that I was probably going to have one of those episodes, and that it was going to be weird because it was the first time I was on the road. And at the end of our trip, it happened. We were in Philadelphia. We were sleeping in a park. Started getting really sick, and I just knew we had to get to the hospital. So I got there, and they performed like, you know, an emergency appendectomy, because it was like at the point where my appendix was going to burst and cause all kinds of trouble. So there was a bunch of crazy synchronicities in our travels that led us to that particular situation where I was at the hospital, because I was supposed to be camping on miles on top of this mountain in Portland. And the kids who we were camping with lost their IDs. So we split with them and decided we were going to take a bus back to Philadelphia for this music festival thing. So I was supposed to be on a mountain, but because these kids lost their ID, I ended up on a bus that led me to Philadelphia, that led me to the hospital. So to me, there was a whole bunch of other crazy synchronicity on the trip that led to just the way everything happened. So for me, it was just this really powerful thing where after I woke up from that emergency surgery, I was just a completely different person. Up until that point, I had no real like spiritual kind of sense about things. I was very critical of everything in the world. I had a very dystopian, pessimistic outlook on reality and just kind of an unhealthy kind of perspective on things. I hadn't quite gotten in touch with nature and peace and stuff like that, you know. So when I woke up from that surgery, I was just a completely different person. I just had this new drive to like realize what life was all about, and I realized that the synchronicities that led me to that hospital and that situation were just like way too meaningful, and it was all telling me that, you know, that road lifestyle wasn't quite for me either, that there was something drawing me back to my roots and stuff. So that after that surgery, I kind of just gave up on my squatter dreams and kind of settled in. And what I settled into was just, you know, trying to get a deeper understanding of what the human experience was about, what this kind of meaningful interpretation that I was having with these synchronicities was about and stuff. So that's what sent me down this whole rabbit hole, was that was just waking up on that trip squatting was just like, holy shit, something's going on. I got to figure it out. You know, so, you know, nothing too exciting, but it was just, definitely, pivotal, you know, so.
Yeah, it's the context for how you're currently oriented, huh? These events, not just the events themselves, but the way that you inevitably ended up responding energetically to what the challenges that life was giving you kind of directed you towards something to make your peace or reconcile or process, I guess.
Yeah, and the beautiful thing that I found further down the line was that as I was discovering, like, some of the spiritual schools of thought and the concepts and things there, I realized that the revolution that I was so invested in on a social and cultural level was also something that was happening on a spiritual level. And I became, like, really identified with this idea that this kind of goddess current is returning and balancing out this patriarchal period, you know. So a lot of my anarchist background was aligned with some of the esoteric understandings of where we're moving through the current age, you know, aeonic processions and stuff like that. So yeah, so I'm still very much like the same radical that I was before I had that synchronistic kind of awakening. But for me, it's, yeah, now I'm kind of always acknowledging that pattern that I see, you know. I don't know. It's not, you know, not any one thing, but.
Well, I'm guessing maybe you're aware, maybe you're not, but you probably are. It's just like, you know, the archetypal shamanic story is, well, not all of them, but oftentimes there'll be, you know, surgery will be performed on them. They'll have something taken out, something put in, usually by entities, but in your case, it was a real world correlative experience. But in the same sense, even leading up to that, you had some sort of sickness leading up to that. And again, shamans, typically there's some sort of sickness in their past or illness in childhood or adolescence or all along the way. And so just in terms of basic shamanic trajectory, you fit the bill pretty damn well. And right. So I guess it's only convenient that you'd be drawn to this other stuff. But as far as synchronicity goes, I mean, obviously it's like, okay, well, life is worth living. There's more to it than that. What's it point you towards? Is it really just how do I live as creatively as I can? Do you have to accomplish some grand goal? I mean, what is it to you?
I guess it's for me personally, the synchronicity stuff is just like, it's part of the ongoing realization of, who we are, you know, or who I am, you know. So I feel like sync just kind of teaches me more and more, or shows me more and more, like how who I am and what I am is connected to this, like, you know, vast, larger, intelligent process that's unfurling, you know. So through exploring synchronicity, I think I explore, I deepen my understanding of who and what I am and thereafter, what I want to bring into the world and what bringing things into the world means and stuff, I guess, too, you know, whether it's just the amount of love and joy you bring into the world every day and acknowledging how much power that has on a quantum synchronistic kind of level, you know. So, yeah, I think sync shows me that, you know, we create our own myth of who we are, and it can also help reveal to us the own myth of who we are. So for me, it's just this kind of thing where it's, I just get drawn deeper and deeper down this rabbit hole of, understanding the things that like turn me on, I guess, you know, and like, not in like a weird way, but in a, the things that make, that excite me, make me curious, draw me, you know, into, deeper mystery and stuff, you know? So I don't think there's any grand like outcome for what sync is, but I think it, it's important for like, to me, for like just a kind of self knowledge and self exploration.
Well, are you like of the McKenna school where he thinks we're moving collectively towards some omega point? Is this purely some kind of Gnostic individual journey through different levels of the super system? Is it neither? Do you not know? Well, we don't know. None of us know, but what do you think?
Yeah, that's tough. I don't know. I mean, I guess my real thought is that, you know, there really just is this eternal moment that we're all in. And, as far as my like five senses have shown me and can tell me, this is what's up, you know? So this is what I work with. This is it to me, you know, this is the, that thing that McKenna was kind of talking about, and not this as in Thelema or this as in Sync or this as in anything, but just the very moment that we're in at any given time. So maybe that's a synthesis of all those things, you know, like trying to realize how much this moment is really the sum of the past and the fractals of the future, and just kind of dig on that.
You know, yeah, the thing that I got from reading, you know, 30 plus books of Aleister Crowley is the same thing I got from my near-death experience last year with ayahuasca. So I don't know if I've talked about this on the show before. I don't know if I told you personally, but just very quickly, I got like an intestinal knot and I couldn't swallow the medicine. I mean, I couldn't digest the medicine. And so I purged for 20 hours straight and I felt like I had been shot in the stomach. It was the most excruciating pain of my life. And I spent close to 5 days in a hospital afterwards.
Wow.
After the, you know, because I was in the mountains and stuff, and it was just extremely horrific. The doctors told me I had, you know, just a few hours to live if I didn't make it to the hospital. Yeah, because if your intestines separate from your stomach, that's it. There's nothing you can do after that. And so that was close to happening. But the point being, not to just be like, hey, I had this crazy experience or whatever. But the thing that I couldn't get over throughout the whole 20 hours that kept on coming up was, you know, and even more so after the fact, when I really knew what actually was taking place, was that, you know, there's this apparent line that's supposed to exist between energetic realms or abstractions or things that would be considered, more conceptually based in terms of that they don't actually exist in space and time, correspondences, and what is actually taking place, that is a very, like what we would consider as more substantial, because it's obviously standing out in space. So coming out after the fact, and I got people, I had a kind of an issue with my, well, I don't need to go into my personal stuff, but there was definitely like, people were like, well, you know, you must have had something spiritually defunct that was related to. I mean, people who do ceremony, everything's about that. They're like, well, what is the real spiritual problem? Like, well, you know, on one level, sure, there's all kinds of stuff I'm dealing with. On another level, you know, where's the line? Because when I was 10, I had 15 stomach ulcers, and they say intestinal scarring is one of the reasons why this phenomenon can happen, where you get your intestines twisted like that, and you're not able to digest. And because it was a purgative, it just inflamed it and made it worse until I got an opioid, and that saved my life. But because it was, it could override it and allow me to relax. But the point being is that from all my study with Crowley, that's what I ended up coming to, was that, wait a minute, the line is very blurred between energies and the way that what we would consider nominal existences or even abstractions actually correspond to the real world and the real happenings. And the line is so blurred. And all it is really for me, like at this point, and what, you know, Thelema represents as far as I'm concerned, at least what the AA represents beyond the OTO and their deal, but like the inner school, you know, is it's like trying to penetrate the mysteries as directly as possible. It seems that the most direct way is recognizing, following correspondences, and just being open to how they relate to real life events. Whether in the past or whether now or rather predicted in the future, you know, and that in and of itself is its own thing unto itself. It's hard to explain, but it is like there is the thing in itself beyond everything we have to say about it. And it seems like that's what synchronicities allow you to delve into and explore without having to ultimately even take a position on it. You know, because I don't even know what that was for or what that was about. People are like, oh, well, what's the purpose of this? On one level, I could just say it's a crazy fucking thing that happened to me that I had to deal with. On another level, it's like, well, yeah, the meaning on a certain level is just self-evident. It's just furthering the thing that I'm already doing, which is, I don't know how to explain it really, but, you know.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I guess not going along the same trajectory, but I don't know enough about this to have an intelligent conversation, so I just want to explain to me, what did Crowley do, how did he change around the deck, the tarot deck? What did he do that was so revolutionary in terms of how he swapped stuff?
You should watch my video.
Well, yeah, it formed the Vesica Pisces, right.
Patrick, because sure. That's pretty much, I mean, that's its basis. And actually, if you go to my blog and you just scroll down to the first blog post, it's not the videos, all it is the Saudi Star issue. I just lay out the whole Saudi Star issue from.
Is that his position or is that your interpretation?
No, that's his. I mean, you can see math. It's a very mathematical thing that he did and symbolic thing simultaneously. You just have to know which cards were switched and in what way, because he switched numbers and then he also switched letters. Mm-hmm. So two different sets of cards, and it's all about the astrological symmetry that gets created because by doing what he did. You make the symmetry closer than it was before, if you're laying the cards out against each other, which is a common tool in Kabbalah. It's like a very well-known thing to do. So you do the same thing with the alphabet, and you're looking at the alphabet when you're looking at those cards. And so you loop it back around to itself. You could take the whole alphabet and then reverse it and compare. That's a tool that's used, but you can also take the 22 Hebrew letters, arrange them into a circle, and then find the correspondences. And so if you do the same thing that a traditional Kabbalist would do with the tarot deck, you'll find that with the old rules of the Rider deck, you couldn't create a perfect astrological symmetry. Yet you can with his deck, with the way that he switched them. You just have to keep certain things in mind. There's certain qualifications that need to be understood. And so those are laid out actually on my blog right now. I mean,
but this is like a pretty intuitive thing that well, I mean, it's a matter of taste, right? I mean, are you really going to get better results from this particular deck, or is it just something that, hey, this is the aesthetic that appeals to me? It has certain resonances or significances that this other deck doesn't have or something. But I mean, can you really take a serious position and say this is better than this one?
Yeah.
Why?
Because it's in the actual symmetry of the thing, it is a finer expression, yeah. It just is. I mean, you'll see why.
But how does that reflect in the divination? I mean, why would that have any connection to the divination itself? Okay.
What do you mean by divination?
Like, well, that's what we're using tarot for, are we not?
Right, but what does that even mean? Because one person's idea of divination is different from another.
I'm talking about the standard projecting the future.
Projecting the future. Because that's not necessarily, like, this isn't even meant to be fortune telling as far as Crowley's concerned. His position was actually more similar to Jung. That he was like, you're looking into the subconscious and you're seeing what's already there. You can affect changes, sure, but that's not that this is actually the function of the thing to predict the future. It's interesting. I mean, it's very appropriate that you'd say that because Crowley's qualification of what determines divination is much different than the general consensus about what that is meant to imply. That's why he had a falling out with the Golden Dawn. That's a major reason, you know. I don't know if you would agree with me, Kevin, but I'm kind of just spouting shit out here that is my understanding. I don't know how much you resonate with. But.
I mean, yeah, I think if I remember too, like, I think Crowley actually ended up restoring the, it was Lust and Adjustment that he swapped, right? For the, it was like the Paris working, I think.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, I'm pretty sure, now I'd have to go back and figure this out, but I think the original Golden Dawn setup had it that way. Then it was changed, and then, yeah, I think him changing it back or his changes were not met with agreement for, you know, and then I think Zadi is Not the Star was something that he then changed later based on his understanding of the Kabbalistic, I guess. What was it? It was Hay and Zadi were swapped because
Zadi is Not the Star, because it's said in the Book of the Law. That's one of the funniest ones. I think that's in the Laws for All as well when he goes into that, because it's just he is like, well, I guess I'm supposed to do this because this is what came through. But when you do that, it sets things into balance, and it really does. And it's a whole mental process to see why it is that makes sense, but it actually all follows. There's one issue though, and that's the relationship. No matter what, you're not going to have a perfect symmetry ultimately, because though every card with astrological associations has its opposite you know, the odd one out is Gemini in relationship to Mars. So it's the lovers in relationship to the tower throws the thing, the whole thing off. I mean, it throws itself off. It's the kink in the perfection, because you have to have a kink. Because if everything was perfectly equilibrized, it wouldn't be what we're actually dealing with.
Right, right.
Because you need the distortion. And so that's the place of distortion, is between the two the tower and Gemini, which you could recognize, like, Gemini is literally the duality. So if you're approaching the tower through Gemini, through the lens of Gemini, you're looking at the duality of the tower, which is why I feel like the two towers reoccur in the deck with the death card and the moon card. Though they don't show up in Crowley's death card, they're there in the Rider version. But you know, I hope you know what I'm pointing at. You know, because that's the significance of the Golden Dawn. It's because you're looking at the sun rising up between the two towers, and then that ties to the 11 thing in the Book of the Law. You know what I'm talking about? The first section of the Book of the Law, he has something about
The perfect and the perfect are 11.
Are one perfect. That's the idea of like one and one in one is 11. But he actually has a reference. I'm actually, right now on my computer, I have opened, Jim Morrison's An American Prayer in the Book of the Law, which I don't know if you ever looked at that before. I feel like I've told you before.
I think you did turn me on to that
a little while ago.
Yeah.
Yeah, this shit blows my mind, and it's hard to relay to somebody what this how this actually came out for me and the significance of it. But I mean, it's pretty crazy, man.
I don't doubt it.
Yeah, like I'm like looking at like this is it gets it's it, at certain points in An American Prayer later on it starts to get silly. There's this whole deal where every section of An American Prayer has a dash in the original handwritten copy. And so I found the original handwritten copy, and I was looking, and I was like, "Huh, that's funny." And I counted the dashes, and I realized how close it was to the first section of the Book of the Law. And then I saw that the Doors' last album, the only commissioned album, I don't know if you'd say commissioned, but you know, Morrison gave the go ahead for a compilation album before he died, and it was titled 13, which is interesting because you'd say 13 is associated with death and all this stuff. And it was the reversal. The cover was the reversal of their initial album, where he's in darkness with his face half turned with the other Doors. And you have here, he's in light with his face half turned, the Doors walking away from him. And then if you turn it over, then you have Crowley's head in stone with the rest of the Doors surrounding it, with Jim Morrison with his hands in prayer over the head. And so if you know the, like, There's a technique that's used in Kabbalah traditionally where they'll weave different texts together, and they can either do it with a single word, or they'll do it with whole sentences, or they'll do it with sections. And so, and that's literally related to the weaving is supposed to be like fingers in prayer. And so I was like, huh, isn't that weird? An American Prayer happens to be the same as the Book of the Law. And I put them together, and I feel like the result is absolutely mind blowing. But there's a certain point where it just like Morrison's words just make no sense on their own, but make perfect sense in the context of what Crowley's saying.
Right.
And that really gets me. So it's like,
I got to check that out again.
Yeah. So he's like, expect him. This is Crowley. He says, expect him not from the east, nor the west, nor for from no expected house cometh that child. All words are sacred and all prophets true, save only that they understand a little. Solve the first half of the equation, leave the second unattacked. Oh, but thou hast all in the clear light, and some, though not all, in the dark. And so you have this whole idea that the rituals are half revealed, half concealed. When this was the rationale for me to do this, was this line where he says, right, solve the first half of the equation, leave the second unattacked. Because I read that, and I was like, well, is he asking you to attack the first section of the book? And so if you align them in that way, where you weave them right after that, Morrison says, he, cut your throat, life is a joke. And so after, you'll see why that becomes relevant. So he says, invoke me under the stars, love is the law, love under will, nor let the fools mistake love, for there are love and love, there is the dove and there is the serpent. Choose ye well, he my prophet hath chosen, knowing the law of the fortress and the great mystery of the house of God. The house of God also is the tower, it's the temple, right? So right. All these old letters in my book are right, but Saadi is not the star. This also is secret. My prophet shall reveal it to the wise. Okay, now we have Morrison. He goes, your wife's in a moat, the same boat. Here comes the goat. And then you have Crowley again. He says, I give unimaginable joys on earth, certainty, not faith, while in life, upon death, peace unutterable, rest, ecstasy, nor do I demand aught in sacrifice. And then Morrison, again, blood, 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 blood. They're making a joke of our universe.
Huh.
Nor do I demand aught in sacrifice. Blood, 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 blood. next line. I'm just going to read this for a minute, if that's okay.
Yeah.
I think it's trippy. Okay, so next line from Crowley. My incense is of resinous woods and gums, and there is no blood therein. It just said blood, 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 and there is no blood therein. Because of my hair, the trees of eternity. Okay, now we have Morrison. Matchbox, are you more real than me? I'll burn you and set you free. Wept bitter tears, excessive courtesy. I won't forget. And so right then he just said, my incense is of resinous woods and gums. There's no blood after you just said blood because of my hair, the trees of eternity. So his hair is trees. So then right after that, you have Morrison saying, Matchbox, you more real than me, I'll burn you. He just said his hair, the trees of eternity. I'll burn you and set you free.
Right.
It's like, and so right. And then after that, you have my number is 11 from Crowley, and all their numbers are with us. The 5-pointed star with a circle in the middle. Are we talking about 9/11 or what?
Right.
You see what I mean? You have the Pentagon, and then you have the two towers. It's pretty ridiculous. So at the end, I'm just skip ahead. At the end of that, he says, also, I have a secret glory for them that love me, from Crowley. Next line from Morrison. A hot, sick lava flowed up, rustling and bubbling. The paper face, mirror mask, I love you, mirror. Next line from Crowley. But to love me is better than all things. If under the night stars in the desert, thou presently, burnest my incense before me, invoking me with a pure heart, etc. You know.
Right.
But it's mirror mask, I love you, from Morrison. But to love me is better than all things. And right before that, I have a secret glory for them that love me. Mirror mask. You know, it's like,
give
me a fucking break, man. Yeah, so I've tripped out on this. Like, and this is the thing with synchronicities, is that sometimes it's hard to relay to people because it's so personal in the process of how you get there.
Right.
And it seems like such an out there idea. You're like, really? Jim Morrison responding to Crowley? I don't know. I'm not asserting that this is indeed what happened, but I don't rule it out. I mean, I really don't. It seems like a very, it seems like it's asked for by Crowley in the first place. And this is where does the point between nominal expression and phenomenal existence actually exist? You know, I don't really know. It's very strange.
Yeah. Yeah, that's fascinating. I think that's awesome. Like, I love that that just approach to creating like that mashed up hermetic kind of perspective, you know. I think regardless of what the intent may have been, there's really interesting correlations, you know, regardless too, you know. So
yeah, it's fucking weird.
And that's the thing for me too, like with a lot of the sync stuff that I follow, is it, I could boil it down to all resonating with like life force and stuff. And like that appears to be for me like an ongoing revelation, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I think anything that we do personally to, mix and mash and understand and synthesize and coagulate and all that kind of stuff. Anything we do kind of serves that process of reflection, you know, as we stay focused on whatever, you know, I don't know, whatever it is that our consciousness focuses in on, everything else gets imbued with that. So then we, through the mashup process, gain more and more, you know, infinite kind of perspective and understanding on a thing. And so I think that's the cool thing about sync and mysticism and divination, is that nothing is really ruled out, and you know, the personal proof can be there, and then that personal proof becomes, a certain kind of, it enters the pool of mystical proof for all to delve into and stuff, you know. So it's all good stuff, you know. That's what I'm feeling.
Yeah, totally. I mean, your work is very interactive. I mean, that's the thing, is that there's a malleability in your relationship with the thing, and how do you explore it? And it's weird where you actually have general rules. Like, I couldn't just do this. Like, I had to make sure that I'm, like, going through the thing. I'm like, okay, these are the dashes. These are the points of intersection. How is this going to play out? And so it's still set up within parameters. It's not doing whatever you want. It's doing what the thing wants. And that's weird. Because you're like, what does this want, like, to do? And how can I help you do that? That's not like, I'm just going to... all you did is you took this fucking text and you mixed it with that text. No, this text is written in a very specific way. This one's numbered and this one's sectioned out. Like, I didn't choose how that would play out. All I did was saw what happened when I inserted the one into the other, you know? It's like,
right.
And that's a trip. It's like, if you have the two, tetrahedrons of a star tetrahedron, and you put them together, and every vector is the same length. You're just putting them, you're mashing them together, but you don't expect that they're actually going to be the same length necessarily. I mean, you know, if you know ahead of time, but, like, you know what I'm saying? Like,
right.
Is this actually everything's going to fit to this degree? Like, that's just crazy.
right.
You're one of those people that I always want to talk to more, you know, like I'm like, wow, you're really immersed in Crowley's work. And I've been immersed in Crowley's stuff. You know, I know what that's about. So I'm always interested to talk to you and get feedback on certain things.
Yeah, totally. It's definitely like exciting to talk, you know, with people who speak that particular language. And I love just diving into all the critical approaches and the different angles of everything. And yeah, you're another person who, like, you know, I've always, when I listen to Always Record and stuff, I'm just, like, always, like, just super impressed, you know, like, with Sig people too. I mean, obviously you've got your knowledge of Kabbalah and stuff and the other things you're interested in, but it's great. I'm always impressed, like, listening in. So now I'm very excited to, participate in the ongoing dialogue, you know?
Totally. Yeah, you were the first blog I ever got into.
Yeah, that's so awesome. That's really, like, that means a lot. Like, to then appreciate your work, you know, and to know that, like, that inspired you in some way is really awesome, you know?
Yeah, the fucking, the blue triangles of the Sri Yantra, was it the red? I can't remember. There was a diagram that you came across where they were pointing out the amount of triangles in the Sri Yantra.
That's right. Yeah.
That's real.
Yeah. It's funny. I remember, it's hard to find, like, more on that particular, that thing. So I have that screenshot saved, and I feel like I've even had trouble digging up more on that mandala. But yeah, I think it's that there's 42 inverted triangles in that Sri Yantra. And that's that, I mean, that, yeah, the last Mimsy where that pops up, that movie is, like, such a sync storm. It's crazy.
Yeah. Absolutely. And for, like, a kid's movie, that's, like, totally, like, random. And I came across something that had a reference to it recently. I was watching some movie and somebody was, like, named Mimsy or something, and then they had, like, a bunny rabbit or something. What the fuck was that? Yeah. Oh, man. I was trying to remember. I don't know. And then you got into this whole moonlighting tip, which I watched yesterday, actually, because I told my friend who's going to be here later tonight that I was going to have this guy on. He was, like, the first blog I ever got into. I was like, oh yeah, I'm stoked to talk to him. And she was like, she's really into the blogs. And I was like, oh, you got to read this guy's blog. And so I sent her a link to your videos on YouTube. And then I went and I was like, oh, wait a minute. I never saw fucking Thin Skin or Membrane Part 4. I didn't know that there was a Part 4. And so I was like, oh, one slid past me. And then the moonlighting episode that you talked about was one that I had tripped out on. I hadn't watched the episode. I was looking up moonlighting because, what's that guy's name? Oh shit.
Patrick Kelly?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
Who's that?
I thought you might mention him. I'll have to, I'll go off on a little bit of it about this at some point because it's really exciting. He's the dude, I think I focus in on him a little bit in that fourth video. He plays, I think his name is, it's like Hornsley or Thornsley in Twin Peaks. And he's in The Warriors.
Yeah, I recognize him. I know
he's he's in that moonlighting episode. He's the guy who's chasing after the leprechaun woman. But yeah, I'm working on Film of Thin Skin or Membrane Part 5. It's also kind of Part 6 because there's like a few of them floating around that kind of make one, but they're two. Mm-hmm. So I don't know which number it's going to be, but it's like, for me, it's crazy. It's another one of those things where like this episode, focusing it on this guy's career, David Patrick Kelly, I'm kind of leaking it right now. But like, it's so incredible how much his career affirms this whole film as membrane reflection of the underworld kind of vibe that I've been digging into. It's just crazy. I mean, I've going through this kind of a Bremelin ritual of watching everything the dude's ever done, which is like, for a while I've just been like, at the end of the night, I'll try to watch something of his as many nights of the week as I can and stuff. And it's crazy. Like I went and watched Mad About You one night. It was really late and I was like, all right, I'll watch something short. So I watched I watched 30 minutes of Mad About You for his 2-minute appearance. And I had just gotten a little bit let down because up until that point, everything in the dude's career that I watched had a pinpoint reference to the overall narrative that I'm tying him into, like, you know, 5 episodes in now. So I'm just getting super excited along the way because it's just like nonstop just hitting it. And then this Mad About You episode just comes on and the woman gets out of the cab where he's driving. And I was like, dang, like there was not a 42, no rainbow there. I just like, there's nothing for me to work with in that one. I'm going to have to let this episode go. And I'm almost going to be done watching it. But then the woman gets out of the cab and she goes into the elevator. And for no reason at all, this dude on the elevator in a suit is going, bands of light, bands of light. And, like, you know, the rainbow is bands of light, you know, bandwidth, the spectrum.
Totally.
And so that just, like, flabbergasted me again. Like, I always get amazed by the different ways that syncs can kind of, you know, come into play and how they do it and stuff. And so I'm just, like, really pumped about this one that I'm going to be working on. I've been compiling all the information, but I haven't even started editing it yet. But it's super cool so far. It's, like, really a fun one. And just that Mad About You sync was just like, I knew it was going to be super cool from that point on because I was like, that's just too ridiculous.
Yeah. I feel like it connected into the fatal thing. So, you know, FATAL, the Eastern Star. It's the Order of Star, and how they have that the pentagram with the rainbow. And so I've talked about it before on the show, but there, okay, maybe it was, oh shit, was this it? Okay, so I saw it and immediately I was like, oh, Fatal Attraction. And it's funny because every point of the star is meant to be a different character, female character from the Bible, because it's women's Freemasonry, right?
Right.
But there was an actor that I was connecting with it, and I was going down this whole fucking thing. I'm losing it. This challenging thing about this kind of subject matter is I didn't retain everything, but I think that there is an episode of Moonlighting. I'd have to look it up. I think it was Moonlighting called Fetal Attraction. And that guy was in it. And then he died shortly afterwards, I believe. And it was, there was this whole thing was tripping me out. Okay, man. I don't know.
Yeah. Sorry. I kind of went off.
No, I'm doing a thing where I can't find information I'm looking for, but it's one of those things where it's like, if I had an hour or something, I could like get back to you and be like, oh dude, check this out. Here it is. But yeah, it was tripping me out the way that this guy died. He used to be on the Halloween movies and stuff. And then it was like his last scene in a movie was so fucking creepy. And it was just him answering a phone with a stranger or whatever. And I'm not doing this fucking justice at all.
Well, yeah, definitely let me know. Sounds interesting.
Okay, well, here's something. This is the meaning of it. At the end of the initiate ceremony, this is from Eastern Star, the signs, passes, grip, and symbols of the order are explained to the candidate, including the letters FATAL, which appear on some Eastern Star documents. These are an abbreviation of the Kabbalistic motto, fairest among the thousands, altogether lovely. The abbreviation FATAL is said to remind the initiate that it would be fatal to the character of any lady to disclose the secrets of the order. And so and so I was tripping out on that in Snow White with the, put her heart in this box, you know, and she, the fairest of them all, mirror, mirror on the wall, who's the fairest of them all, because it's literally fairest among thousands, altogether lovely is the meaning of the thing. And so, yeah, it was just,
here's some interesting stuff now too, that I'm thinking of too. Like, so you just, revealed to me that the Shekinah, is supposed to be that the rainbow is its like pure form, as you're saying.
Yeah.
So then it's interesting
form,
that this
form
that,
in material expression, like the closest approximation of Shekinah is the rainbow.
So that's amazing, because then the Order of the Eastern Star uses that rainbow, and they themselves are that feminine, vessel for that. Masonic divinity, you know. So, and then to go a little further in another interesting way is a really strong feminine archetype that we see used in, I'm pretty sure, their symbolism and just the feminine like mysteries in general is, you know, Lady Justice and Mott. So fairest as in, you know, the balanced scales of Mott. So there's an interesting scales 42 rainbow connection there through that whole Order of the Eastern Star, Shekinah, fair and balanced.
Totally. I actually take the Snow White thing very literally, because the meaning of Snow White in the first place. So, you know, that when in the Disney film of Snow White, when the queen takes out the box and says, I want you to bring her my heart in this box, she's surrounded by flowing garments from above that all have, it's blue with white stars all over it. So she's sort of surrounded by these pentagrams, and the box that she hands her actually has a heart on the front with a sword through it. And if you know, you know, the tarot, you probably would, you know, you'd think maybe the Ace of Swords, but the Three of Swords actually pictures the three swords going through the heart. And I was looking at that explained, it was the idea is that the sword is a symbol of intuition. So in a way, it's pretty straightforward. Or not intuition, excuse me, the intellect. So you'd say the sheath of the airplane, right? So the plane of air, you know, the air, air, you know, because the sword, that suit relates to air. But that it's literally when the concept has been proven. So if you're spinning around with a concept and then it's like, wait a minute, no, this is actually hitting a reality. It's as if the heart, the thought, which is the sword, is actually going, it's piercing the heart. Right. Meaning that's no longer just a concept because it's been put to the test. And so for her to do that, and she is like the opposite of the Snow White. So you have, and they're two roses, right? That's the idea. I mean, Shekinah was related to a rose among the thorns. You say a flower among the thorns, and people say she's a lily, but lilies don't have thorns, so she's become equated with the rose. So she has been for freaking ever, which is why the Virgin Mary is associated with the rose. But yeah, it's just, and then the rose is the heart in Rosicrucianism, as we know, and then there's the weighing of the heart. So that's it's just a very profound kind of thing in a
right,
you know, yeah.
that whole identification of the you know, the intellect with duality, you know, Mercury being the alchemical symbol of kind of consciousness itself in some sense, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really interesting there, that that perspective on that. I think that's cool too, like the intellect penetrating the heart, it's kind of like the squaring of the circle kind of thing, you know, like the intellect has its kind of limitations and its binary boundaries, you know, but, you know, the heart and the intuition and the imagination and stuff,
Have you heard of Joseph Chilton Pierce?
No.
He wrote a book called Heart Mind Matrix, where he's basically, he puts forth the scientific argument of basically what you're saying, that connection between the intellect and the heart. And so forever it's been folk wisdom, okay, your heart or your gut instinct or whatever. Actually, what certain evidence points to is that the heart and the mind are part of, a kind of a larger intellect construct as far as the physiological body goes. I mean, obviously there's a non-local element to the conscious experience, but as far as what is registered in the body, what's processed in the body, how we synthesize information, what we're receptive to, so on and so forth, the heart actually, well, not only do they start out in the embryo in the same sort of sac, and then they separate, the brain gravitates towards the head, and then the heart stays where it is, but they start out as a unity and become a dyad.
Right.
And so they're always connected in that sense, that they had the same origin or so, well, are always entangled in some deep quantum sense. But as far as sensations are felt, I mean, before certain conscious decisions are made or so on, you know, a lot of the research is focused on the unconscious mind, and the unconscious is registering things before things happen or so on and so forth. But there's just as much good evidence that points to the heart registering all sorts of information and processing before we take our actions as well, as far as like our senses go and the information we do take in. So anyway, just to kind of go on a short little tangent there, I'm sure I brought that up at one point or another, but I like that, at least for me, whenever I'm trying to say, okay, I kind of get this sense, is there, we can always draw on natural history and just anecdotal stuff, but I'm always interested, I guess, as a Westerner to know what's been done in a lab, what's been done in a more, I guess, even if magic, if we think of it as a methodology, at least there's some rigor to it. I mean, what kind of rigor has been applied to this question beyond just people talking about it, you know, and intellectualizing about it? So I guess that's why my mind is drawn there. But anyway, to close out.
Cool.
Yep. Yeah, it's always a challenging thing on the show when I'm trying to, like, you know, kind of stealthily look up information on things that I'm wanting feedback or understanding on simultaneously while talking, you know?
Right.
But yeah, it's like trying to dig through and find shit when I should just put that aside and just fucking have a conversation.
Well, it's in the flow of the camera. You want to be like, oh yeah, there's this part that
it's
might
fucking
factor
thing.
In.
It's just yeah, very it's challenging when you're dealing with, the kind of stuff that we're dealing with, you know?
Yeah, you can't keep everything in your head. I mean, one of the best lessons I learned from one of my teachers was, it's like, you don't have to remember everything because A, you either have books that you can always reference, or B, you get the fucking internet. And it's just like, that's the truth of the matter. So you should demand a certain amount of excellence out of yourself in terms of remembering what you can and being able to pull stuff just out of your mind. But I try to give myself a break. It's like, sometimes you gotta look shit up, and sometimes it is relevant. So when you're trying to do it in the moment, yeah, it's challenging, but the impetus to do it makes perfect sense. And just the fact that you need to also makes perfect sense, because just our mind is so limited when you really think about it. So little is conscious. And not only that, but it's just like our filters are so tight. The mind can both have all this information in it, but we have so little access to it. It's fascinating. So that's why I like, I'm not super deep into magic or anything, but I like the premise of ritual and what have you, opening up that channel between whatever our two minds.
Oh, okay, I got it. It was fucking Donald Pleasance. So you guys know who Donald Pleasance was?
No, I'm gonna look him up.
Yeah, he so if Patrick was on right now, by the way, speaking of which, John, Patrick is probably gonna be on the show every so often, just as like same offer that I posed to Jason Barrera, which I wish, and it would be nice if he was able to. I think his computer might make it a little challenging, but I'm like, you can come on the show any freaking time, you know, no matter what, because dealing with somebody that's like a full on walking encyclopedia, it's like they might as well be here for what we're trying to do. But
yeah,
Patrick has this whole awesome thing with Donald Pleasance. He could probably go off on him for a while, but his final film was called Fatal Frames, and then I found that really interesting. That's really eerie, the way that it ends, you know, 1996. He had a lot of correspondence with the Beatles. He, in fact, would produce songs with was it Ringo or something? And he sang a song on the Sgt. Pepper's movie, and he was just like, and the Ringo, he was included on a couple different Beatles collages with albums and stuff and different things that they had made or whatever. It's just a very,
I know who you're talking about.
He was,
now,
he was in Sharon Tate's debut film, as like a satanic priest kind of guy centering around the King Kill ritual. That movie is about the Golden Bough. That's her first movie. And she's right there with Donald Pleasence, who you just, you'd expect. But yeah, I believe, I think it's him. I think this is the thing is that his final film was called Fatal Frames that he died during. And then he's in a Fetal Attraction episode of Moonlighting.
See, that's right. Yeah, yeah. He's like, in Escape from New York, too. I just saw on IMDb there.
Yeah, he's in a lot of stuff. But yeah, he is a fucking sink gold mine. Speaking of, like you were saying with this other character, you've been looking at his whole career. Yeah, Donald Pleasence is just one of those guys. You're gonna geek out on sink, man. It's just fucking endless. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm skipping through here. There's definitely some interesting titles.
Yeah, I don't know. He's been in so many freaking things, so that makes it easier. But I was trying to, I guess, yeah, TV is just included. So, oh yeah, his first movie called The Dybbuk. You get it? You know, Dybbuk is a, you know,
that's that
directly related to the Gollum.
They right. might as
well called it the Gollum. I mean, that's the thing. You have like a Dybbuk in a box.
Like it's like a, yeah, a demon container thing, right?
Yeah. So if you've seen, well, it's not the container, but it's the thing in itself, right? So, or I guess you could say it's a container because it's the body, right? Being utilized, but, that's what you'll see in, A Serious Man. The same guys who did like the Big Lebowski and whatever, the Coen brothers. So one of their more recent films, which is about Kabbalah. Admittedly, I mean, it's what they say, that's what it is, and they play with Gematria in it directly, where they're like, this guy is looking at Gematria, and it's all like, he's trying to, do you know what I'm talking about? Have you seen this?
Which movie is that?
A Serious Man.
No.
Yeah, dude, the fucking Coen brothers made a Kabbalah movie, and it starts
in the
16th century with like a rabbi, and then this Dybbuk shows up. And you're like, what the fuck? And then it's like most of the soundtrack is like Jefferson Airplane from a Surrealistic Pillow and stuff. And it's
oh no way, that's crazy.
It's a Jewish community in the 60s.
That's serious, man. Like you know, serious. Like,
yeah, that's the joke. Because everyone trips out with not everyone, but us weirdos. You know, we trip out on the Coen Brothers in Sirius. In the first place, we were already looking at that correspondence with nobody fucks with a Jesus 8-year-olds, dude. You get it? You know, he represents the fucking church. That's the whole point. And he's a pervert. So, you know what I'm saying? And then he's the box of moonlight. He's, you know what I'm talking about? Like that actor who is the Jesus. What's his fucking name? In the Big Lebowski.
Yeah.
I forget.
Oh, no. Yeah. I'm not sure.
Yeah. This box of moonlight was like one of his big first big movies, I guess, or it's up there. Yeah.
John Turturro, I think, right?
Yeah, John Turturro, Box of Moonlight, 1997. Huh? Yeah, that's.
I think I might have to stay up late and watch A Serious Man tonight now.
Oh yeah, man. Yeah, that's definitely recommended for sure. Super, super classic. But yeah, I was trying.
That's wacky. Yeah.
So interestingly, oh no, that's Fatal Frames was 1996. Box of Moonlight was 1997. All right. I'm such a fucking weirdo. I'm like, Moonlight, Box of Moonlight, ooh.
Oh, no, yeah. I was thinking that too. I was thinking, like, the whole demon box theme of, you know, that kind of connection between the Clefoth and the night side of the Tree of Life, and there being some kind of a, you know, a connection between the lunar quality and
dude, totally
the Fada quality, you know.
Yeah, the Klepot are literally the demunation of the moon. They are the dark side of the moon. That is how they're described in the Zohar. And so that's why I find it really interesting whenever you're dealing with, you know, moon symbolism, you want to look at the specifics of how it's being communicated for that reason. Oh, funny, dude. John Turturro's name in Box of Moonlight is Al, A-L, Fountain.
Oh, wow.
He's the Fountain of L. The Fountain of Bina. Bina is the Fountain. That is so fucking trippy. And then he's in the fucking other ones. See, that's the thing, dude. This is how this works. So fucking John Turturro, he's in the Barton Fink as the main character who's handed the box by fucking Walter, John Goodman.
Uh-huh.
He's the fucking Jesus in purple, because purple's the color of Sirius. Even if you look behind in – so when he takes out the dog, when Walter takes out the dog when they're in the bowling alley in the Big Lebowski, if you look behind him, you'll see a ball that says, like, Holy Star.
Uh-huh.
And I haven't seen the movie. I haven't seen Barton Fink, but the poster, it's like he basically looks just like Harry Potter. He's got like a thunderbolt on his forehead. There's another Jesus impersonator. Dude. So
yeah, and I guess did you mention this? There's a John Turturro film called The Moon and the Sun. I'm not sure if you mentioned that.
No, I didn't mention that. I'm just following this as I'm going right now. I didn't think about Box of Moonlight until I was like, wait a minute. That's fucking weird. Yeah, I wonder what that is. Jesus.
Oh, yeah, and then he's in Secret Window, too.
Oh, shit, which is Hey. And that's the whole thing, is that Saadi is not the star. I tripped out on that. Yes, people think sometimes, man. Holy fuck. And then the fact that he put Johnny Depp in it, right, I think around the same time as he did The Ninth Gate. Which is about the same premise. Because you have
dead
the switch.
Secret Window.
Yeah, because Saadi is not the star means that it's Hey. So he switched Hey with Saadi. Hey is the window. Yud Hey Vav Hey is a window and another window, right? So you have the two windows or the two females. So you have the mother and the daughter.
Oh, and interesting.
Which are the moon.
Right, and this is the moon and the sun. And the title, it's like the sun in terms of a familial sense. And John Turturro plays the son, so there's that Christ connection too.
Oh, weird. Are you saying Secret Window or Secret Passage?
Secret Window.
He was in both. He was in a movie called Secret Passage, and he was in a movie in Secret Window.
That's great.
Weird.
And he's like the like creepy butler in Mr. Deeds too. I don't know.
That's the same year. He did Secret Passage the same year.
And he's the voice of Monkey Bone in Monkey Bone.
Oh, fuck.
Dude, that whole movie is about the other side. And then it came out in 2001, so you think about the monkey with the bone in 2001.
Oh, totally.
Oh, man.
Totally. It was in fucking a TV movie called Monday Night Mayhem, Night Mayhem, another moon reference. And the Moon Key. Remember the Jake Kotza video? Yeah. Moonkey, that's the name of it. It's one of my favorite sync videos of all time, actually.
Oh, yeah, that's a great one.
Oh, he was in Summer of Sam. He was the fucking... He was fucking Harvey in Summer of Sam. Dude, you don't even know. Oh, my God, that's weird. Okay, so just to give you a context right now, the other night, I got this urge to watch Summer of Sam, which I haven't seen since it, like, came out, which was in fucking, like, 1999, right? So I'm like, I remember that being a really good movie with fucking John Leguizamo or whatever. I'm going to torrent it, which, you know, I only do if I really want to see a movie, you know?
Right.
And, like, I was like, I'm in the process of doing that. And I'm like, okay, I'm going to fucking look up some Peter Lavinda video just to watch him do some talk or whatever. I don't know if you know who Peter Lavinda is, but he's a very interesting researcher guy who goes into some very fucking territory with the fucking CIA and everywhere. He goes all over the place. But I'd never heard him fucking talk about the Son of Sam before. And like, I was like tripping out on Sam because he has, you know, Samael, you know, and the Kleepote, that's the head of the Kleepote other than Lilith, you know. And so I was like tripping out on that Summer of Sam, weird. And didn't he get instructions to kill by dog? Oh, fuck, Sirius. And like, wasn't the fucking dog's name Harvey? Oh, fuck, Sirius. And so I'm like, because Harvey, you remember, like, with Robert Anton Wilson, it was because of fucking Harvey, because it was Mr. Wilson. That's the fucking tall bunny rabbit, which was contacting him from Sirius. And then when he looked it up in the library, it said, hello, Mr. Wilson, which is a reference to Harvey, the fucking dog. that was supposed, the 1,000-year-old dog that told fucking the Son of Sam, the postal worker, to go postal. That right. was, the fucking dog's name was Harvey.
Oh,
and
man,
it's a dog,
true.
So it's like serious. So I'm watching this fucking Peter LaVinda thing, and he just starts going off about the Son of Sam, which I'm not expecting. I happen to be downloading fucking Summer of Sam movie. And then he's talking about this fucking cult. Was it the Process Church or whatever? That was basically this weird religious cult in New York City during that time. And he was giving evidence for the killings that were equated with Kaczynski of being from this cult, and that he only killed like a couple people, and yet they put it all on him. And that it was actually these people were doing it for all these other reasons, and it was their ritualistic killings and the 44 killer. And then you have this Spike Lee movie comes out that's pointing out the ridiculous synchronicities of that happening, because you had fucking was it Reggie Watts? No, not Reggie. That was a Freudian slip. Reggie, the New York Yankee. What's his name? Reggie. Jesus, I'm losing it. Number 44.
Jackson.
Yeah, Reggie fucking Jackson. Thank you. And he was the 44 caliber killer, and then you had Mr. 44 was like, you know, and then they were like, oh, there was a rumor at the time that Reggie Jackson was actually the 44 caliber killer, which is really weird, but it was because of the whole movie is based around people mistaking synchronicity. Because they're running with the clues, and then they're killing based off the little information they have, but it's all because of these correspondences that they're making. And they're like, oh, this is this guy, or fucking whatever. I don't know if you've seen it. But isn't that fucking weird that he would be the voice of the dog that's Harvey the black dog that tells him the thing? He gets the message from the dog in the same way that Robert Anton Wilson got a message from the fucking rabbit, but the dog happens to be named Harvey? You're fucking killing me.
All right. Yeah, so I also just went a little further down IMDb on that, and I found that Totoro, I guess he directed this movie called Illuminata, and I just posted a picture of the cover in the message chat thing we have here. It's crazy. It's the moon, and it's like a woman going up this staircase, and there's one pillar, and it's just like... the symbolism and like the Shekinah resonance and stuff is all just so like, I don't know. It's so strange to just be looking at like at the end of the conversation, like after all of our conversation, you know?
Yeah. I'm trying to,
there's eight people on the left, eight nodal points on the left. Yeah. Right. Am I counting?
Oh
right?
Yeah. Right.
And then moon on the top. Okay.
I don't know. Right. I downloaded this new version of Skype, and every time people put stuff up, I don't see where to find them again, so I don't know where it went. Because if I just go, whatever, I'm having challenges seeing it.
I think I might be able to...
This might be it. Oh, there we go. Okay, cool. Yeah, I can see it. Except to download
it. Funny, there's...
Illuminatus. Oh, so this is just from IMDb.
Yeah.
Over here. Cool.
Interesting. Yeah, that guy's got quite the...
Oh, I got a different image. Is it 2014? There's another Illuminatus.
Oh no, it's Illuminata, like with
Illuminata.
Yeah.
If that's funny, that that is totally it, dude. That is a tracing board.
Right.
You're looking at a tracing board.
Yeah.
It's called Illuminata. And it's a stairway to Sirius, but it looks like it's going to the moon. Because a stairway actually occurs on the middle pillar, right? But there's actually a pillar off to the side, even.
That's right, yeah.
I find it really interesting looking here. In 1996, John Turturro did Box of Moonlight, and right afterwards you have Grace of My Heart. So I was just fucking going off about take her heart and put it in the box.
Right.
But the heart is equated with the moon because it's the Bina. And so that's really interesting.
Right, yeah.
Huh.
Great.
Weird. Yeah, everything is it's a sink gold mine. Jesus. All right. Well, maybe we should, I don't know.
I'm tired. I've been tired, so I'm
Yeah, yeah. Up. This has been awesome. I'd love to talk to you again. We should have you on more often.
I think that's the plan, so we'll see what we can do.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you, Kevin.
Yeah, Kevin, yeah, thanks a lot, man. And I'm sorry I was late again, but I appreciate you staying on late.
Oh, totally. It's been a lot of fun, man. Like, I'm really looking forward to continuing talking with you guys and stuff. It's been fun. Yeah, definitely.